You've heard the headlines. Get some perspective now with Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
It's being called a terror attack, the largest this country has seen. We're talking about New Zealand this morning.
The lead.
At least 49 people killed in a mass shooting at two mosques full of worshippers attending Friday prayer on what the prime minister is calling one of New Zealand's darkest days. A man arrested, charged with murder in what appeared to be a carefully planned racist attack. Police also say they've defused some explosive devices in the guy's car. Pamela Hughes here with you this morning, as well as Barry Markson helping me hold it down here today. And Barry, frankly, I hate the mornings that I've got to crack this mic and tell people of yet another mass shooting anywhere in the world, this time in New Zealand. And as I've been listening to coverage here on KTAR this morning, as well as several other media outlets, I've kind of struggled with how to talk about it, what to talk about, because we talk about these things all too often. But there is one aspect of this story that really jumped out to me, shy of the number 49, shy of the two mosques, the hate associated with it. It's the fact that the shooter live streamed the attack.
Yeah, we're in a whole new world now where everybody thinks the world is a video game, and they're living in it, and they're living out a video game fantasy, and that's what this guy did. He put his camera on his head, and he went in, and you saw everything. He shot the guy at the door of the mosque, and then you see him shooting everybody inside that. And you know, the question for me, Pamela, is that something that we should want our social media companies to keep us from seeing, or is it something we should allow ourselves to see if we're so inclined?
Well, the police in New Zealand notified Facebook right away, and they took down that video. Take a listen.
I want to point out a specific section of Facebook's statement that said, New Zealand police alerted us to a video on Facebook shortly after the live stream commenced, and we removed both the shooter's Facebook account and the video. The big question here, Dana, is why did Facebook need to wait for police to tell them what was happening on their own platform?
Yeah, I mean, I get the argument that the reporter there is trying to make. In a perfect world, Facebook would have known about this and would have been able to remove it immediately. But we don't live in a perfect world, and the algorithms are always jobbed. And sometimes, you know what, it is an algorithm, it's AI, or it's an individual who's sitting behind a desk up off of the I-17 and Dunlap at Cognizant that are watching these videos, having to scrub them from social media platforms that they maybe didn't get to it fast enough. But I get the argument that you're making, Barry, as far as should it be the social media platform's responsibility to take this stuff down?
Yeah, I mean, you want them to be responsible citizens, and you want them to certainly not to support or promote this sort of activity. And so I get the question, number one, is do you want these terrorists or these murderers to get the publicity that they're seeking by having them up on social media and then everyone copying them and putting them on YouTube and everywhere else? Or do you say, no, take those down? But I will say there's part of this seems like a little bit of a big brother to me. It seems like they're trying to protect us. And I always come back to 9/11. This is awful. But when that was happening, before the towers fell, people were jumping from the World Trade. It hurts me even just to say that, but they were jumping from the World Trade Center. And most of the TV stations, they didn't show us that originally because it was too gruesome, and it was. But is that something we should see to understand the evil that was involved there? Is this something we should see? Maybe that's what we need to see to get people fired up enough to make change, to do something different, so we can stop this sort of thing.
I get the argument, but I know bad people exist. I know that you're going to have some nut jobs, such as the case in New Zealand, go into not one but two mosques and slaughter 49 women, children, and men. I don't need to see it to know that it exists. I get the big brother argument to it, but I am not of the thought that everything deserves equal play and equal opportunity to get out there into the public domain. I'm not. And you can call that censorship. You can say, well, there's a First Amendment right. I don't need to see it to know that it exists.
Right.
And so I appreciate that Facebook took it down, but I think Facebook's only part of the solution. We also have a responsibility ourselves, because you had said a little bit earlier, Barry, that people are sharing it. That, you know, it gets up and it starts to get shared and people go looking for it. Well, that's an us responsibility. That's not something that, like, we should be doing, but yet we are. So the question I want to ask our listeners on the open mic line is this. Who has more responsibility here? Facebook to take down the video, or for us not to see it, share it, or go look for it? 602-200-2733. 602-200-2733.
Yeah, it's a tough question. And I'll tell you, we were talking about this earlier. For example, the beheadings back when the terrorists were beheading U.S. citizens or U.S. soldiers, and it was awful. And that was online. You could find that online. I never watched one.
Me neither.
I don't want that in my mind. I don't want to have to try to forget seeing that, so I never watched one. And you're right. It doesn't mean I don't know what happened. It doesn't mean I don't know that the people who do that exist and that they're evil. And I agree with you. We don't want to promote this guy, these terrorists that go in there, these murderers that go in there and do it. We start to get to a point, though, where we're blaming Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and whatever else we're blaming, YouTube. And is it really their responsibility to be the video and online policeman of the world? I don't know. I appreciate that Facebook took it down. I think people who were upset with them that they didn't take it down fast enough don't understand how this works.
No, I'm with you on that, but I do think that they bear a lot of the responsibility.
Yeah.
And part of it, though, you talked about the beheadings. I, too, Daniel Pearl, did not watch.
Right.
Don't want to see. Don't need to see. I'm the type of person that replays those things over in my mind, and they keep me awake at night.
Right.
Which makes it very hard to do this job sometimes. But here's why I'm glad they took the video down and why I want Facebook to do a better job of it. And that is because before me right now, I have a written description of what transpired off of that video.
The video, white supremacy and these attacks on
the video that the shooter, the monster in New Zealand took as he entered two mosques yesterday, late last night, and gunned down 49 people. I've got a description right here because the New Zealand Herald did watch the live streaming video, and then they began to write about it. The gunman began shooting indiscriminately upon entering the mosque. As I got to the second paragraph of that, or the second line, rather, of that description, I stopped because I'm reading about it, right? And I didn't know I was going to start reading about what actually transpired inside. And seeing it is one thing, reading about it is another. Because when you're reading about it, then even your brain starts to kind of fill in the gaps and you start imagining what took place. And frankly, I don't want
to
know.
I look at it, and it's interesting. None of the TV networks are going to show this video, obviously. And to me, that's appropriate because the TV might be on in your house. The kids are in there. It can come on without you realizing it. And suddenly you lose your choice whether you want to watch it or not. Online's a little bit different. There will be people who will seek this out, and they'll find it. It's out there. There will be people who will seek it out and want to see it, and they'll look at it. And then there will be people, apparently like us, who don't want to see it, and we're not going to seek it out. And I guess my question is, where should we fall as far as the responsibility of social media? Should they be now spending their entire day with teams of hundreds of people scrubbing their site of every single person who's putting this up there in the hopes that 15 more people like something they posted? That's where we are right now.
We are, because we know that that's already happening. We know that there are groups of people, again, there's a whole team of them up off of I-17 and Dunlap, who are watching these videos every single day. And, I mean, this is grotesque enough. I'm not going to get into the other things that they're watching and they're pulling down because it's explicit content. There's a responsibility, I think, on all of our parts, but primarily on the Facebook and these social media platforms. And I know how that sounds, folks. I know how that sounds. Like, who gets to decide what I get to see?
Right.
I know how that sounds. But I am just not of the belief that all kinds of content deserves the equal amount of protection.
Yeah, and I agree with you, by the way. This I'm considering this to be news. That's why I'm wondering whether this should be there or not. I agree with you. No, I don't think all content should be out there by any means. But this is a little bit different. And I think for some people, seeing the jumpers on 9/11 kind of brought home the depth of that tragedy and the depth of what occurred there. I don't know that we all need to see that, but I think you should at least have that choice.
What do you think? Give us a call on the open mic line, 602-200-2733. Whose responsibility is it? Is it ours? Is it the social media platforms? And would you want to see this video? give us a call. 602-200-2733. That open mic line is brought to you by Carol Royce with Keller Williams Realty East Valley. Hey, coming up next, there is a survey that shows parents, well, they don't want their kids to grow up. There's no news there, but really the lengths that they're going to prevent it, well, that may have you scratching your head a bit.
Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Depending on your age, you think it's either Kathleen Turner talking to you or Elastigirl from The Incredibles. No, it's me, Pamela Hughes. Voice is a little scratchy this morning.
I thought your voice was just deeper in person.
Isn't it? Yeah, you know what? It sounds kind of good. It's good for the radio,
that's right?
Right. Now, I'm battling some throat issues. But it is me. That, though, is not Bruce, okay? He is not battling throat issues. That would be Barry Markson. Thanks for helping me out here today, man.
Absolutely.
So, Barry, do you have kids?
Yeah, I have two boys in high school, a junior and a freshman.
Okay, I've got a 9-year-old daughter, Riley, and I'm pretty involved in her life. I mean, she's 9. You would expect me to be pretty involved in her life. And my parents, frankly, were pretty involved in mine all through high school and even into college. So I wanted to dive a little bit into this new survey, I guess you could say, that came out from Morning Consult. And what they found out is that young adulthood in America is very different today than it was when we were growing up. Okay, it's always different than the generation before you, right? No big news there. But what we're finding out is that even when kids become grown, 18, right? They become an adult. To about 28, the level of parenting that the generation or that age range is getting is maybe vastly different than what we experienced?
Yeah, there's no question. I don't think my parents talked to me when I was in high school, but it's I'm kidding, Dad. So, no, but it is definitely different. And you see it, we see it when our kids were younger, like your daughter's age, what they call the helicopter parents,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Involved in every aspect of their school. I remember when our kids were in elementary school, we knew a mom who was in the classroom every single morning talking to that teacher, and who knows what else was going on. And it just shocked us that you have to be that involved. But we see it. We had friends who could barely go out for dinner because their kid had to have only a grandparent could stay with him. Even when he was older, 10, 11. And he would call half the time if they were out, and they would just leave and go home. Not because of an emergency, not because anything happened, because they were that intimately involved in every aspect of his life. And if he even coughed wrong or thought something, Mom, where are you? Then Mom would come home.
So if you're doing that level of parenting that you just described when they're 10, yeah, 11, 12, what does that manifest into when they're 18, 25, 28? Well, we have some data.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this, and play along in the car if you're driving. When you were in college, go back to college or right out of college, getting your first job, you know, late 20s, how often did you talk to your parents, whether they lived down the street, if they lived across town or across the country?
Yeah, I would say I'm going to say twice a week. And I'm sure my parents would say that's not true because it was probably less. I've never been like someone who calls my parents a lot. I always got yelled at about that.
Sure, sure.
But other people do that all the time. Like they want to have that contact. That's great. I kind of hope my kids want to talk to us more than I did.
I was surprised, I got to admit, that after I had graduated college and my now husband and I, you know, were hanging out with some of his friends. There was a woman who I'm so very, very close friends with. But at the time, like every single day she was talking to her mom. Every single day. And texting and talking. And I'm like, that was weird to me.
Yeah.
Because I was in the same camp. My parents are across the country and I might talk to them once or twice a week at that point in time. Now it's even longer.
Right.
But it's not every single day. What we find in the survey is that parents are talking to their kids almost every single day. Half of them still live in the basement. No, actually, it's a third and it's not a basement here in Arizona, but you get the point. But what about this survey? What does it tell you? If I were to ask you, did your parents, Barry, ever remind you as an adult that there were deadlines that you had to meet, like homework?
No.
Me neither.
Never.
But yet, 18 to 28-year-olds right now say that about 75% of their parents do that.
Right.
How about this? Did your parents ever, between the ages of 18 and 28...
I feel like you're doing a Jeff Foxworthy routine here, yeah.
Did they... make appointments for you, like including doctor's appointments, dentist appointments?
No, never. If they did, I don't remember. But
you know what? I'm thinking about like the exceptions maybe to the norm here. Like, okay, I'm in college and I go home for the summer.
Yeah.
And mom goes, oh, you need a dentist appointment. And she schedules it for me. I think that's one thing versus like being on my own out here at ASU and
right.
having a throat issue kind of like this and mom making me a doctor's appointment out here. I think that's vastly different. But what this article really gets into is the balance between supporting your kids, like having that emotional support that they know that you're there for them. Sometimes it's even financial support. My parents helped me financially post-college. I mean, I graduated with a broadcasting degree, for goodness sakes. It's going to take a little while for me to get my feet underneath me. So it's a difference between supporting your kids and stifling them.
Yeah. And it goes both ways. I mean, I have a friend of mine now who had his son who's a freshman in college and said, hey, can he come watch you for half a day? And he was doing it with a lot of people, so his kid could be exposed to different
Perfect.
Things. I think that's a great thing.
Absolutely.
So, and the kid wouldn't have done that on his own. There's
No, and that's where you need that parent's guidance. But as you have parents increasingly involved in their grown children's life, it boosts that relationship, which is great. But it also kind of teaches the kid that they can't do it on their own.
Yeah.
Right? So whether it is making a dentist appointment for a grown child, helping them study for a college test, giving them advice on their romantic relationships.
How about calling their employer if they're having a problem at work? Can you imagine your mom calling your boss?
Has your parent ever done this? Like, do you have a story that you're willing to share? You can change your name. I don't care. It's cool. Give us a call on the open mic line. 602-200-2733. If your parent has ever done this for you or if you have ever done it for your kid, then why? 602-200-2733. So are we entitled to privacy? I got to tell you about this homework assignment a law teacher gave out that revealed just how much information we are divulging in public without even knowing it. It's a bit creepy. It'll open your eyes. And it's coming up next here on KTAR News.
KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
But you know what? Even if we're in a public place, we still kind of feel we have some sort of privacy. How do I know that? Because when I tell you what this law professor did, the optional assignment he gave his students, you're going to think it's creepy. And the reason why you're going to think it's creepy is because we do have some level and expectation of privacy when we're in public. Take a listen to this. This teacher teaches privacy to law students. So he gave his students over spring break this optional assignment. He said, at some point in the next 2 weeks, I want you to try to determine a stranger's identity in a public place. So simply by using Google search on your phone and based upon the thing the stranger says loudly enough for a lot of people to hear, well, we've all been there, right? Or what the person was wearing, you know, logos on their clothes, their bags, anything, monogram, anything along those lines. See if you, through a simple Google search, can identify that person. A lot of students thought this was creepy. Do you think this is creepy?
Oh, it's creepy.
That's Barry Markson that you just heard there, not Bruce St. James. He's helping me out here today. Why is it creepy?
Well, because you don't want people to be able to find that much stuff out about you. But the fact is, it's there. It's all online. You can find out. You just search somebody's name now and you get pictures of them and their vacation photos. And I mean, it's amazing. People think even just Facebook is protected or Twitter. It's not. Everything's out there. It's really amazing.
So
now,
the fact that we all think that this is creepy shows the notion that we all think some public spaces are private. Here's the deal, though. Are they a little bit different? Like, our public space is different. I think we act differently, say, in a quiet doctor's office than we do maybe in a loud airport, right?
Yeah.
So some students took him up on it and emailed him. Wait till you hear this. One student who was initially against privacy regulation in class, she argued, well, you know, if you got nothing to hide, you shouldn't care who's watching or listening. How many times have you heard that before? She was shocked. Sitting on an airplane, she listened to a guy in front of her on the phone. He was arranging for his pickup from the airport. He revealed enough in that conversation, she was able to find his name. Another guy on a train overheard a guy's first name, typed it into a Google search, combined with the name of the college, on his shirt. Within a matter of moments, the student was able to find out, even without the guy's last name, that he was, what his college major was, what he minored in, what year he graduated in. And it helped out that, yeah, he was wearing the shirt on the train that he was in the outfit online. And this just goes to show that even though we are in public and we think we have privacy, and you think you have privacy because you think this is creepy, you think it's creepy that people are listening to you, you really don't.
Have you ever done that in public where someone's speaking loudly on the phone and they don't think they are, or they don't care, I guess?
How do you act? What do you do? Do you do anything?
Well, I've done this a couple times. I go up to the person and I answer their question that they're asking on the phone.
No, you do not.
I do.
You're that guy?
Yeah, just somebody who's that loud. Where they're being loud. I don't do it if someone's speaking appropriately for where they are. But if someone's speaking so loud with no awareness that there's other people around them, and usually they either get mad or they get embarrassed and they kind of go away. But they shouldn't be that loud.
Oh, preach, brother, preach. I was up at the soccer fields, Reach 11 fields, for a tournament a couple weeks ago. I'm on the sideline watching my daughter play, and there is this woman. Oh, my goodness. I don't know where the heck she thought she was, but I learned about her mother, her grandmother, what was going on with her sister. She was in a bad mood. And all the parents are like, they're just kind of doing that look.
Right.
Like that when a person talks, you know, behind you at a movie theater, you just kind of do that look and give them the eye. She didn't care.
Yeah.
But how about this? Another student said, I was at Starbucks. There was a guy who seemed to be in a fight with his accountant. He kept getting louder and louder and was repeating his social security and full name on the phone. After the third time he did it, I wrote it down and I handed it to him.
That's awesome.
Have you any of these stories? Have you any of these stories where you've been in a Starbucks, you've been at a soccer field, at an airport, on a train, and you're just surprised at what people are talking about in public? Because I was raised where, you know, you keep it in your house. Like, you know, what is it? You got family business here, right? Nobody else needs to know that. But now it's everybody's business. Share your stories with us on the open mic line, 602-200-2733. What is the craziest thing you've ever heard people talk about on their phones in public? 602-200-2733. Now, does this then demonstrate, Barry, that there is a need for more privacy?
Well, yes. I mean, I think we should be looking at enhanced privacy, but really what it shows is that we need to protect our own privacy. You're talking about people speaking out loud in public. This isn't somebody, I mean, obviously this little exercise the professor's doing is there, but this isn't somebody hacking you or stealing something from your house. This is you out in public talking without awareness that people are there with you. You don't have a right to privacy in public, by the way. That doesn't happen. Legally. So people need to be aware of that. If you want privacy, don't put it out there in public.
If you want privacy, what this is telling me is you got to work for it.
Yeah.
It's got to be intentional. And you have to be aware. They were talking, one of the students in this article was talking about how her grandmother always told her, you don't say your full name in public. You never say your full name. They were from a small town.
Right.
You don't say your full name in public. And I'm like, I'm from a small town and I was never told that. Like, I never, like, okay, but that kind of makes sense, especially in today's day and age, especially given this law professor's assignment to pretty much eavesdrop on some stranger's conversation and see if they can identify them through a simple Google search and the amount of time that they were able to do it. Now people aren't necessarily Googling you when you're at in the supermarket, right? But
no.
They can, and they did in this optional assignment, and look what happened.
You just reminded me of a thing. The only time I ever tell my kids don't say your name in public is when we're at a hotel. Because
Because
I always think of the movie Fletch, with put it on the Underwoods tab. So I always tell them, don't say out loud your name, because I don't want them people walking around going, yeah, put it on Markson's tab. So I always tell the kids,
that's the same thing,
quiet
like,
down.
What's your room number, right? Because
exactly.
Also just charge it to the room. Like,
right.
Keep it low.
That's
right? Exactly
right.
What is the craziest thing you've ever heard somebody discuss on the cell phone? I know you got stories. Share them with us on that open mic line. 602-200-2733. This was a biggie.
Yeah.
It's not over yet. There's still a lot of twists and turns to it. So we're going to dive into it. A court decision yesterday is going to allow parents of the Sandy Hook shooting victims to sue the gun company. How can they do that? I thought there was a law against it. We'll explain it to you. And does it set a dangerous legal precedent? That is coming up next here on KTAR News.
Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes. KTAR News on 92.3 FM.
Yeah, and I think we do need some perspective on this story that started to break yesterday. And that's why I'm glad that I have Barry Markson in with me, who is a practicing attorney right now, to break this one down. Headline reads, Sandy Hook Massacre. Remington and other gun companies lose major ruling over liability. Here's what happened yesterday.
The Connecticut Supreme Court allowed the families of nine victims of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting to sue Remington over how it marketed the Bushmaster rifle Adam Lanza used to kill. The families believe the weapon was marketed to civilian consumers when it's suitable only for use by the military or law enforcement personnel. Remington argued federal law immunizes gun manufacturers from liability, but the ruling said the families could bring their lawsuit under the Connecticut Product Liability Act, which recognizes deaths resulting from wrongful advertising and marketing practices.
Okay, Barry, clean that up for me, because, yeah, I was under the impression that gun makers were pretty much untouchable in this sense. And are they now?
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, so back in 2005, Congress passed this law that basically gave blanket immunity to gun manufacturers. And the reason was that there were groups out there suing gun manufacturers a lot when guns were involved in crimes. And the purpose, I think, of some of these people, some of them were families who wanted compensation for what happened. But for some of the groups, it was to put the gun manufacturers out of business.
Activists.
Right, activists. Okay. So in 2005, Congress said, all right, enough of this. And you know about the NRA and all the lobbyists that they have. And they passed this law that, frankly, I think is a little bit too broad. It basically gave blanket immunity to gun manufacturers. That's not enjoyed by any other industry in the world, really. I mean, car manufacturers don't have that. No manufacturer has that. So the gun manufacturers get it. It's incredibly valuable. And since 2005, anytime you've added a gun manufacturer to a case like this, they just get out because of this law. There is an exception that's written into the law. There's two of them. One is for advertising and marketing materials, if those advertising and marketing practices violate state law.
Okay.
And in this case, it's the Unfair Claims Practice Act, like you say things that aren't
true.
Right. And then the other thing is called unjust enrichment, in essence, which is to say that if they, it was a negligent entrustment, that says that if they gave a gun or sold a gun to somebody they knew would be dangerous, they knew it wouldn't be safe. And what they argued there was that by marketing these guns to troubled young men, to disturb young men, and then giving them combat-ready weapons, the gun manufacturer should have some liability for that as well.
So this is a marketing issue in some regard.
Right.
There's a bit of marketing in here and how these guns were marketed to folks. So I wanted to take a look at some of the marketing, okay? Some of the slogans. Apparently, the AR-15, Bushmaster, that was used in this attack had the slogan, consider your man card reissued.
Right.
Okay, you're an attorney. What would you argue that slogan says in a marketing capacity?
It says that they're looking for people that they're going to get their masculinity from their gun. They're looking for people who are hyper aggressive. They're trying to attract those people to buy the guns. So the gun manufacturers will say, no, we're here for self-defense, right? This is to protect your home and your family. But really, their marketing is to people like an Adam Lanza, things like that. And they marketed it, and this is what the court found, that with messages of combat dominance and hyper-masculinity. That's what they marketed it to. Now, I will say, on the other side of that, Pamela, I'm sorry, that Adam Lanza didn't buy this gun. His mom bought the gun. So this is interesting. I don't think this is over. And keep in mind, this is the Connecticut Supreme Court that issued this ruling, not a federal court. This is far, far from over. There's going to be other rulings. But this is the first time that a court has allowed this to go forward. And if the trial court starts and they can do discovery, this is going to let them get documents from the manufacturer. It's going to let them get email and communication. And these are things that the gun manufacturers have been hiding at all costs.
Yeah. What these families want is they want the secret business strategies. They want the marketing plans. And so while the court in Connecticut has ruled that, yes, the Sandy Hook families can sue a gun maker over that rifle, it's not a final victory for those families. The case now goes back to a lower court, further proceedings, possible trial. So this is in your wheelhouse. The marketing, I don't want to call it a loophole, but I mean, that's kind of what they're targeting in this. Does it work? Does it have validity to it?
Yeah, it's. I think it does. And I don't have all of the. I don't have the briefs and everything that
sure,
was filed.
Sure, no, I get
filed,
that. But, it's just an opinion.
But I will tell you that it's and a loophole is not a bad way to say it. But
okay.
For some reason, they built this exception into the law, and I don't know why. Because they were obviously trying to get blanket immunity. Frankly, I think they should have these exceptions and maybe some other ones built in. The Congress could have written the law better to provide the general protection so that these gun manufacturers wouldn't go out of business, but yet find them responsible so that they're responsible to the community. So it isn't just making this about guys who want these guns to make them more masculine, but it is for self-defense. They could have limited it in those sort of ways.
Barry, would it open itself up to setting a different legal precedent, though, for other products?
Yeah. I mean, this absolutely opens that door. But again, it's the Connecticut Supreme Court. It doesn't have, if a case is brought in Arizona, it doesn't have precedent here. But it's the first time it's been found. It was a very, obviously, these are some smart lawyers. They got creative. They looked at the law. They looked at the advertising. They got smart with it. And they found, at least in this case, one Supreme Court willing to listen to them.
All right. Hey, you know what? Education, hot button issue in the state of Arizona for a variety of reasons. We know that last year there was a lot of talk about reforming charter schools and creating some transparency about finances. Well, the state Senate has passed a charter school reform bill. But is it actually going to do anything?
Don't get too excited.
Yeah, we're going to dive into it coming up next here on KTAR.